have a rather unique perspective on these issues as I look at systems from the view of the attacker, from the designer meeting the system requirements needed to make a network actually work, and then also as a defender after things have gone wrong. So, at these talks, I've seen a lot of discussion about individual tools, whether they be vulnerability assessment tools or protection tools. Really interesting, neat talks. My talk's going to be a little different. My talk is about some of the fundamentals of architecture design, including and then also getting into specifics about how to secure systems management protocols in an untrusted network within the DMZ. I think that there needs to be more focus in this area, and in particular in systems management and secure architecture design. Systems management protocols, as they've been developed throughout the years, have always been focused on the enterprise network as an internal entity. There hasn't been a really well-defined thought about zones of trust when you're using enterprise level system management protocols. As a result, oftentimes system management protocols turn your entire network into one big zone of trust. A lot of security requirements aren't built in. You take a look at most system management protocols, they have some trivial authentication and also some trivial access control, and that's about it. So what I want to talk about today is implementing those system management protocols in an untrusted or semi-trusted network if you're concerned about security. I'm going to outline some examples of some threats that you'll see in networks today, courtesy of Security Focus, and then go into some DMZ network architectures in the real world. I'm going to present you two core designs and then provide you with some advanced design issues, such as multi-segmentation in the DMZ, dealing with partner and co-location DMZs, and then finally give you some hands-on information on how to do system and network configuration for systems management. So the threat is definitely out there. I mean, you take a look, for example, at SNMP. What's a common running joke is that the acronym stands for security, not my problem, where you have world writable community strings, well-known community strings, usually private, which will actually allow you to reconfigure multiple devices. Not only that, but you've got, for example, buffer overflows on SNMP agents that will allow you to get complete control of the host. Sniffers, one of the most, what you would consider to be one of the most innocuous applications possible. I mean, they're just sitting there passive, but actually Microsoft served us up a network monitor full of buffer overflow vulnerabilities where a single bad packet can actually corrupt the entire network monitor process. But to be fair, Solaris and Snoop and also TCP dump also have the same problems. So it's not necessarily as simple as you think. Yeah. Remote control software, besides its intended functionality of providing console-like access when you're not at the console, you've got problems with weak authentication in VNC. You've got a situation where, in PC Anywhere, that if you send a malformed packet or a lot of packets to the listener service on PC Anywhere, it'll actually crash the whole box. This is not the way system management protocol should be behaving. Administrative interfaces over intended functional protocols. So you install a web server, and guess what? It throws in an administrative servlet that allows you to have control of that application. Like, for example, a layer called Fusion. So you got all these administrators who've locked down their boxes real well. You know, they've got, you know, the firewall rule set up, and they're only allowing port 80 in. But all of a sudden, their cold Fusion servers are crashing left and right. And that's because if you went to the administrator page and typed in a password that was too long, it actually crashed the entire Cold Fusion instance. The administrators didn't even know it was there. The Cisco, the well-publicized Cisco vulnerabilities, the 700 series router DOS and the 675 web administration, we got routers that are running web servers for administrative interfaces. And if you send a malformed URL to Cisco 675, it crashed the whole router. I mean, so you have to actually think about some of the administrative interfaces that are going on your core architecture and component designs. You got threats at system logging. I mean, you've got your common attacks of, you know, log floating, log erasing, selective log editing, and the like. But not only that, as script kiddies love to do, there's an actual denial of service vulnerability on Linux, on an older version of Linux syslogd. Again, unintended behavior for system management. One of my favorites was if you wanted to crash a Solaris 2.4 box, send it a syslog message with an IP address that doesn't reverse lookup. It actually crashes the entire syslog process. Again, not intended functionality. You got backup software. You always have the common problem of unauthorized restore and delete. You've got unencrypted backups that are walking out the door with the crown jewels. You've got the backup agents themselves. I mean, Veritas backup agent has a denial of service vulnerability that'll allow you to bring the whole host to its knees. So, I've probably got some firewall administrators here, some network administrators saying, "Ah, that's no problem. I've got my routers tightened down. I got my firewalls set up right, so no system management protocols are going through. I mean, heck, I'm not allowing people to connect to my backup agent over the internet." Well, it's not enough. And you want two words for why it's not enough? Aggravated penetration. So if I'm able to get into a single box in your network at a low privilege level, for example, the IIS Unicode exploit, where I break in and have a low amount of privilege, and then from there can send SNMP commands to another host to reconfigure your router to open up those tight and Titan firewall rule sets that you have, then the game's kind of over. Privilege escalation, you know, using buffer overflows and system administration and system management daemons once you have a single level of privilege to escalate to another. And of course, the all common insider attack. A lot of DMZs that I see are very hard on the outside, but actually allow end users in the internal corporate network to connect to the DMZ to the back end. And those system management protocols are wide open. So DMZ hosts are bastion hosts and perimeter services hosts. And I want to kind of have you have this question in your mind the entire time of why do we spend all this time hardening our DNS servers, always making sure that we have the right bind patch, and then we leave a poor password on the SSH service that's bound to an untrusted interface. It's kind of putting our priorities in the wrong place. The DMZ exists to mitigate risk by isolating certain services and functions in a separate segment of the network. Segmentation by isolation is generally not enough. If I do ingress filtering, which is typical, I have a nice crunchy outside layer, but then I don't have the soft, I still have the soft inside layer. I need to have defense in depth. I can't just assume that once I'm protected from the outside world, that's enough. So I need to make sure that my internal hosts have the same level of security. So I want to give you an example. This is a common DMZ configuration that you see out there today. You got your internet connectivity with a border router and firewall going in through these bastion hosts, DNS server, web server, FTP server, mail server, going to an internal perimeter choke router firewall into an internal network. So this is one type of DMZ where you'll see bastion hosts. Another type of DMZ that you'll see, this is another one, it's where you have dual home bastion host. In other words, two network interfaces, one on the front end and one on the back end. You might be using outside public addressing. You might not even be using NAT or anything like that at this perimeter firewall. And then you're traditionally using internal IP addressing on the back end, so that perhaps you only bind SSH, like for example, to the internal interfaces, and only the the intended functionality of the untrusted protocols on the outside interfaces. Unfortunately, when you have this type of dual-home design, oftentimes the interior router will directly connect to the outside router so that traffic doesn't have to flow through the bastion host. I marked red as untrusted, green as trusted, and as you can see, I've kind of slashed this as both trusted slash untrusted. You got to make sure that you have the right level of permissions at both of these interfaces to protect against attacks from the internal network by bypassing the DMZ altogether. You oftentimes see perimeter service hosts in a flat network, and I don't know how many security firewall vendors I see. Well, I'll name a few: Cisco, NetScreen, Nokia with the Checkpoint appliance, where they have a three-port firewall. They've got your outside interface, your inside interface, and your DMZ interface. What? I think that's a horrible, horrible design, and it actually promotes bad design. So what you've got here is you've got a single device that is responsible for protecting your inside network from the internet, as well as you've got a DMZ segment here in the pseudo untrusted, semi-trusted land. And guess what? How are you going to administer these boxes? Well, you got to allow system management protocols through these internal hosts through the same router and firewall that you're using to also connect to the internet. I often see this deployment in smaller mom and pop or medium to small businesses where they don't have the money to spend on two routers or to put dual homed hosts in. Unfortunately, security vendors love selling the DMZ port because it makes them look like they're actually being flexible when actually they're giving you a poor security posture by this type of deployment. But if only if DMZs are that simple. You're probably looking at these diagrams saying, well, you know, this guy has never seen a real production network. Actually, I have. One of the things that you'll see is you've got a situation where security consultant geeks and wonks like me go in and you do an audit of your network, and we go, oh man, you know, you got your database server sitting next to your web server, sitting next to your app server. You know, you got to have defense in depth. You got to segment those suckers. You got to, you know, separate them. You got to put separate router ACLs and compartmentalize everything. And the system administrator is sitting on the other side of the table going, oh man. So that means I got to put in more routers. I got to deal with more routed tables. I got to worry about the performance of the backups over the routers. So, you know, how do you administer these boxes then? Like, let's say I've got my web server and my app server sitting here on the front end, and I've got my database server and my app server on a separate segment, and I wanted to admin the web server from the internal network. I got to pass through two firewalls and two firewall rule sets to get out to that web server interface, which requires a lot of rule management. And sometimes you'll even see a bypass. Like, for example, in traditional deployments, I'll see, well, we segmented some of it over here, but oops, I got the mail server. It's got to connect right through. So, you know, it's a difficult situation. But it gets even more complicated. After segmented DMZs, you got co-located DMZs, or you've got, for example, a corporation who has part of its corporate presence, you know, right here down at the bottom, where, my pointer is acting flaky. But you got the corporate facility where they have the corporate services on the DMZ, for example, the mail and proxy servers out there. And then you've got maybe your production e-commerce site up there on the top, where you might have a web server and an application server and a database server on the back end. So oftentimes what you'll see is at the perimeter, at the back end routers and firewalls, you'll actually see either a point-to-point or VPN connection between them. So, like, say I'm a system administrator over here in the internal network. What I'll do is I'll actually connect in via SSH maybe to a management host over here where I can administer all of these boxes. So this presents interesting challenges for the system administrator. Then we've got partner DMZs, where you have mutually semi-trusting and or distrusting parties. So let's say company A wants to provide a Company A and Company B get together and decide they want to provide a joint service to the internet. So let's say Corporation A has maybe a database server here, and Corporation B has an XML feed, and then you've got a web server sitting over here that presents them into a unified front. Well, it's all good and well once you've gotten to this point, but how do you administer the web servers in a mutually distrustful DMZ? This may be co-located in a, you know, in Corporation A's website, web farm, or it might be in Corporation B's co-location facility, but you also have to worry about in here, especially in this DMZ, making sure that Corporation A doesn't attack Corporation B to get a leg up or get advantages. So you've got all kinds of problems in the DMZ. You've got other problems. Constant change. I mean, you've got the marketing department that tomorrow needs to promise all these partners that they would get these, this marketing website up so that they can send new graphics and new pyramid schemes to all their customers. And, you know, don't worry, they've built the host. You know, they'll just throw it on the network. Just give me an IP address and I'm good to go. Wow. Too many hands in the pot. You've got systems management protocols and service protocols that are not designed with security in mind. Here's one of my other pet peeves, is you've got scalability mechanisms which create an additional separation and obfuscation of a clean network design. Load balancers are a horrific violator of this. So you've got load balancers that you're connecting in at level two of stack that are using a single VIP virtual IP address to present a web server or the like. And imagine that you have that configured without a dual-homed host at the back end. You've got to make sure that you're addressing the individual IP address when you're trying to do system management of those hosts that are behind that VIP, rather than addressing the VIP itself. If you address the VIP itself, you're playing craps about which machine you're actually trying to administer. In addition, you've got collusion of disparate types of traffic going through the DMZ. The DMZ should be as simple as possible. There's no reason that I should have an SSH session flying next to a customer web session, flying next to a backup session, next to an SNMP trap, all on the same wire. The risk management has broken down if that's the case. So I don't know if you've ever seen those cop shows where they show the guys being hauled off in the back of the police car. You kind of blur out their faces, or you draw a composite sketch of a expected offender. And this is my kind of composite sketch of the status quo of DMZs today. And this is a pretty common setting from what I've seen. You see no centralized login. You see SSH inbound from the internal network and often from the external network as well, so the system administrator doesn't have to drive into the corporate facility at 3 a.m. when the servers crashed. You've got PC Anywhere, VNC, SMS accessible from management hosts, or worse, just the entire internal network. You've got backup systems that are either non-existent because, heck, the DMZ network hosts are expendable, right? Or you've got backups batch copied to internal hosts because all the backup software is running on the enterprise network that the guys set up, you know, before we even had a DMZ. Wait a second, there's something wrong here if your untrusted hosts are actually making internal connections to trusted hosts in order to upload data. You've got a problem there. You've got default administrative protocols and interfaces left accessible within the DMZ and from the internal network. You got SNMP running on routers, you got web interfaces running on servers, and thanks to Cisco and Microsoft, you can actually switch those around and actually have web interfaces running on routers and SNMP running on servers. You got OpenView or other enterprise monitoring systems pinging and getting SNMP data from the inside. So securing system management components requires a combination of network architecture and system configuration in order to actually achieve these values. So what I'm going to present to you as two core designs. The first is a combination of management and production traffic on the same untrusted segment. So let me walk through this slide. So you've got the internet here. where you've got your intended production traffic up top here, and they're going in and connecting fun, and then, you know, some joker's trying to send SNMP traps to your web server or your SSH, and you can see a firewall burning up the protocols right over here, and you see it exploding. Then you've got your router and your firewall perhaps sending syslog messages to your log host over here, same with the web server. You've got your inbound web traffic, your production web traffic, your inbound SSH coming from, let's say, a management station that allows you to do SSH to the internal host. You've got mail servers that are using its intended functionality, as well as perhaps receiving SNMP queries from an SNMP monitor. You've got a choke router and firewall here that allows system management protocols but denies everything else. So, you know, if for some reason the mail server is misconfigured and tries to send a DNS packet to the log host, you know, the router firewall knocks that out. So this is a pretty typical configuration of where you actually have the management and production traffic shared on the same untrusted segment. And I'm going to define the untrusted segment as where an untrusted user or process can place packets on the segment. So there's an important distinction there, actually. I mean, users are that's a pretty simple thing to define. You know, you've got somebody initiating a web server connection to your DMZ host, but then you've also got untrusted processes such as XML feeds or database queries that are running from as a result of untrusted user input. There's some advantages to this design. It's simple to manage. You don't have to deal with multiple interfaces, and your firewall rule sets are easier to manage under this situation. I mean, you've just got two things to administer. And it looks relatively segmented. But there's problems. There's the problem, first of all, of bandwidth utilization. So what happens when I've got, like, for example, a backup host connected to this system administration network, and I want to run a backup of the web server every night, and at the same time the web server needs to talk to the mail server for production-oriented traffic? You often have battles of your production traffic versus your systems management traffic. You also failed to segment different types of traffic introduces security risk. So as a result, for services that require you to listen to input, you've actually got to configure, like for example, the web server. Okay, I'm going to have to listen to SSH coming from certain hosts, but not other hosts. And compared to if you block it off at the network segment level. It's harder to monitor for policy violations because, for example, let's say, you know, you do actually run some web system, web-oriented system administration. It's going to be very hard for you to distinguish with your IDS or your other session monitoring tools what is an administrative web connection versus what is a production-oriented end-user untrusted connection. The untrusted segment behind the firewall will advertise management services, and as a result, the compromised host on the segment can spoof or just plain initiate a management connection. So I present to you a second solution. And this is a separate management LAN. So under this situation, you've got dual-homed hosts, and this is a relatively simple one. So you've got a web server and DNS server and a mail server. You've got untrusted interfaces sitting on the front end. You've got untrusted interfaces sitting on the back. You've got some other services running here. You've got, for example, and maybe an SSH gateway that you can connect to from your internal network that allows you to connect to, you have to connect to this, and this is a hardened, well-monitored host that allows you to SSH to the mail server, the web server, and the like. You could have a log host sitting on the management LAN that could be connected maybe to an out-of-band system like a pager gateway or the like, to like running Swatch to monitor process violations. And if you're really paranoid, you could set a serial cable set up to the log host to a PC that's not connected to the network at all to do dumb logging. And then you could have, for example, a console server, which you could never do. You could never put this console server, for example, on an untrusted segment, no matter how good your router and firewall configuration is, because you're actually connecting to the hard console, maybe your router, maybe your web server. So if these machines crash in a hard way and the SSH daemon dies, you don't actually have to go to the colocation facility to reboot the host. So this protects bandwidth on the untrusted network segment and reduces another hurdle for intruders to jump interfaces, which can be locked down more aggressively. You're able to monitor your violations within a segment much easier, because you'll be able to say, okay, the only types of CGI access I should see on this segment is the ones that I've intended my my production users to use, and the only type of web traffic that I should see on this segment is, for example, Cold Fusion web administration tools, for example. A lot easier to break down. You can place log hosts, monitoring hosts, and control components in the management LAN with less risk, and also reducing your reliance on the internal network. It also allows for more flexibility with private address space and less border firewall concerns. You don't even have to run NAT on this router and firewall if you don't want to, and deal with all the headaches that, that NAT gives you if you're using if you're using Bastion host with a management LAN. Whoops. There are some disadvantages. You need to make sure that forwarding is disabled on the dual-homed host. This is one of the major complaints that I hear about using a dual-homed host with management LANs, is that I can't get the packets to go where they need to go. And the thing that you need to make sure that you're doing is actually configuring your routing correctly on each host, so that that you don't send packets where you don't mean to. So make sure your default gateways are set to the internal internal router, not the external router, and make sure that you have defined static route for your hosts. Management LANs can still be used as a conduit to attack hosts if not properly or secured and monitored. However, guess what? You're going to be able to monitor these segments a lot easier and have a lot more expected traffic analysis, because you properly segmented and defined your network. It also adds complexity to segmented DMZs and a potential bypass mechanism between segments. So if you go back to my issue of the segmented DMZ, where you have multiple segments, if you don't design your management LAN properly, you can actually use it to drop from one exterior untrusted host all the way to the interior of the network. I'll give an example of that here. So this is kind of my Uber slide here. This has a lot of things going on, and I'll walk through it. You've got connections to the internet. So this is what you would see. This is getting closer to a real production network. You got maybe a internal corporate network over here, and you've got a production network over here. So maybe this is a book selling company, and they've got their router and firewall over here protecting their internal corporate network. Maybe they've got an IDS deployment where they have a promiscuous host running IDS that goes to a backend IDS master here. They've got their production web traffic that goes to their web server, their production mail, FTP. They've got a back-end management LAN here, all aggregating to a monitor or a syslog host here. So you've got a web server, FTP server, and a production mail server, all sending syslog and maybe SNMP traps right to this box. And if there's an emergency, then it connects to an out-of-band pager network right away, so that you don't have to wait for further aggregation for systems that are failing. Then you've got an internal management LAN where you've got, for example, an application server with a monitor syslog box sitting next to it, because you've already got a zone of trust here and you've got some choke points here, so you may be able to get away with putting your monitor and syslog box in the same segment as your application server, because this should be a trusted segment, because it's already going through three choke points: the router firewall, the Bastion host, and another router and firewall. You've got your database server on another segment, so that you can properly segment the traffic between your application server and your database server. Maybe you've got your backup system running right next to your database server, so that the backups run smoothly and quickly. And you've got another aggregator for your monitor and syslog here. Then you've got your back-end master management network, where you have a monitor master that's pulling all of these monitor boxes and aggregating, performing analysis such as SNMP aggregation, syslog aggregation, running process monitoring, looking for odd things in the logs. You got maybe an IDS master here, and then you've got to do system administration. So let's say you've defined an SSH gateway that you can use to connect to from the internal corporate network. Now this would usually be a private line, a private T1 frame relay. relay, VPN, or maybe a VPN connection going to the SSH gateway, which then allows you system administrators to SSH to the back-end interfaces of these to control these hosts. So that's that. This is kind of my Uber slide, where you'll see what I'm trying to get at on this point is that if you aggregate your management connections based on the natural segregation of the segmented DMZ, that you'll actually reduce your management LAN bandwidth. You'll have all the advantages of segmented DMZs so that you don't have to worry about bypass mechanisms. Like, for example, if someone cracks your web server and then connects to the management LAN interface of that web server and goes straight to your database server when the normal the production traffic firewall rule sets would not allow that. You've got disadvantages. You've got more equipment and more routes to maintain. You got to maintain ACLs and rule sets between the management LAN. You got additional points of failure, and you've got all the disadvantages of segmented DMZs that they're typically hard to administer. Yes.
So you have the two routers for the internet access, one for public network coming in, and one for out access out. What is the function of the green line between the two routers?
Oftentimes what I see, and this is not necessarily a recommended practice, but I wanted to try and capture what often happens, is you'll see a private connection between the internal router and firewalls and the production router and firewall as for load balancing mechanisms or to keep production corporate traffic that needs to connect to the production network off out of the internet and only across the perimeter routers instead, so that I don't have to go all the way over to the internet to connect to the untrusted interfaces of, for example, my production web server from the corporate network. Yes.
Given that you manage configuration of routers and EFTP, what is the thing you can do with that?
Oh, well, this actually works rather well. Since you have, except for your most perimeter firewalls and routers, which should be configured by console only, your other routers and firewalls would be connected to the management LAN, and therefore you can safely have a TFTP server implementation, of course, with the appropriate ACLs and limitations on the routers and firewalls. So one of the other design issues that you got to think about, and you probably heard me allude to it earlier, is with the backup system, is pushing versus pulling data. So, you know, you've got zones of trust here. You've got this is the most untrusted area right over here. This is getting more trusted. And then once you're in this zone, this is extremely trusted. And you want to make sure that traffic flows from the untrusted, from the trusted sides out to the untrusted, and that untrusted hosts aren't making connections or pulling or pushing data into more trusted zones. So if you push data from the internal network to the DMZ admin LAN, that's good. But still, make sure that you've put in the appropriate limitations to make sure your internal users aren't using it as well if they're not system administrators. DMZ admin LAN pulling data from the internal network is bad. What I often see is someone popping a file over on the internal corporate network as a batch job and then having the database server go over there and suck it out of the internal corporate network at midnight every night. That's a really bad design, because traditionally your internal corporate network should be your most trusted network. Or at least from the outside world. Who knows what your users are doing? But then you also need to, when you do have to push data, you should consider what the degrees of push are, because there are different degrees. You can do file and data transfer one way with or without validation. So, for example, an anonymous FTP connection or a scripted FTP connection is a limited, very limited push, versus an interactive transfer with restricted privilege, where you actually have to have people, FTP to host or telnet to host under a restricted shell, for example. Or then, of course, remote control administration with full interactivity, where you have SSH root shells. Obviously, that's the ultimate push. So you should always try and deploy the least amount of push possible. Ask your developers, can you do this just with a single file upload where you don't need, a NOC person to actually physically move the file over? Try and limit the amount of exposure that you have there. So you want to use the minimum amount of push whenever possible. When DMZ host needs to push data for administrative purposes, aggregate in the same trust boundary, and then pull from the more trusted environment. So what we have here, for example, is we have a monitor syslog box that's aggregating all my logs here, and then the monitor master goes in and pulls that rather than the monitor and syslog box pushing. So it'll be much harder for attackers to corrupt your master log system because they're not allowed to initiate connections. They're only allowed to have connections initiated to them. Never have DMZ hosts pull or push from the internet without the appropriate risk analysis and mitigation. Antivirus vendors are a big abuser of this. I see secure mail gateways that actually go to the internet every weekend and download a new virus signature, upload and deploy new executable code on the mail servers without a system administrator ever checking it to make sure they even work, let alone whether it's secure. This is horrible, horrible design. System administrators must check these types of things because, I mean, if you spent all that money to actually build a virus content protection server and then you're allowing it to update itself arbitrarily and on its own, you're out of luck. And what made my hair fall out is there's certain IDS vendors, I won't mention any names, but some of them are actually allowing you to update your IDS signatures over the internet automatically in a pull mechanism. Again, not something that's recommended. You need to take a look at what those changes are and not have them run lights out. So we've gone over some network designs. At this point, I hope you have some ideas about how to maintain secure DMZ architectures and some of the system management challenges that come along with those network architectures. So now I want to talk about, with the time that I have left, to talk about four major areas of system management and give some concrete recommendations for backup, diagnostic, and availability monitoring, remote administration, and system logging. So let's start with backup solutions. There's a lot of risks that are present when you run backups. There's a bandwidth utilization. I've seen a lot of system administrators pulling their hair out because at midnight, the whole network grinds to a halt as the backups start to kick off. You've got unauthorized restore and backups. I've seen really complex ACLs put on individual files on a DMZ host, and then an intruder tries to get the files. Darn it, I can't get to this darn file. Oh, wait, I can run the backup program and get a restore of that file that I wanted and throw it in the temp directory where I have access. Oops. You got capture of backup traffic, which is an obvious thing, and thanks to people like Doug Song and his file snarf program make it even easier. You have agent vulnerabilities such as authentication, that most backup agents, commercial software backup agents, will allow any backup server to connect to them and to start initiating data connections. You got procedures for restore offsite that you have to deal with. I mean, who do you trust with your tapes if you store them offsite? Are they just being thrown in your CIO's kitchen drawer, or are they actually being maintained by licensed couriers who properly sign in and sign out every tape? And do you check them? And of course, what I see oftentimes in the DMZ, especially for companies that are growing, is they just throw tape drives on every DMZ host so they don't even have to worry about that. Unfortunately, local backup devices on each DMZ host are often difficult to scale, and guess what? You've got a tape management headache of trying to maintain and catalog every tape that's being used by in the DMZ. So I've gone, if you go to an Exodus or a AboveNet, go and walk around the cages and see how many tape drives are sitting there with this tape spilling out of them, and and how you could easily just grab a broom handle and whack one of those tapes over across the floor under the cage, and you got the crown jewels. Backup clients are not necessarily designed with security in mind. I'm gonna talk about that in a little more detail in the next slide after this one. So if you're going to secure backup solutions, you have to protect the backup server at all costs. You should definitely place it behind another firewall or a filter, and the backup server should initiate all backup and restore requests to eliminate inbound connections. You should never allow your backup agent software to initiate restores. If you do that, then if the system is compromised, the attacker can do it just as well as a system administrator. So you have to allow only restores to be pushed from the more trusted backup server to the agents that are actually getting the files restored. You also need to consider the physical security of the server and the media. Again, my co-location cage example, and implement tight security controls on the server. Then one thing that you'll see oftentimes with system auditors or security consultants is say, well, do you encrypt your backups? And they're arch an eyebrow, knowing that they'll at least have something to write about. But actually, there's risk and benefits. It's not an easy checkbox type of thing. You need to ask yourself, well, is the wire insecure? If the wire is insecure and I'm running backups over that wire, you know, I've got a lot bigger problems than whether or not my backups are encrypted. I got to wonder why that wire is unsecure in the first place. And if so, the client's got the burden of encrypting the data, which is often slows down backups dramatically. You have to store the data encrypted. Do you store it and encrypted or not? How's key management performed? What happens if the key is lost? I've been in very unfortunate and sad situations where I've seen system administrators teams that have a backup server where they store all the keys to the backups tapes on the backup server. And guess what? The backup server fails. Uh-oh. Out of luck. Also, do you encrypt both the on-site and the off-site media? I would argue that you maybe don't need to think about encrypting the on-site media because you've got physical security mechanisms that should hopefully mitigate that risk. But on the off-site, I mean, do you trust the courier to make sure that he doesn't make a pit stop at Burger King on the way back to the vault and someone breaks into his car? I think it's something you need to think about. So the administrative LAN segment is very beneficial for backup solutions. Also, you might want to consider using a storage area network, which often use backup solutions that don't even run over the traditional LAN at all. I'm going to give an example of just one hard to secure product, and this is Legato. However, Veritas and Seagate and all the other ones have the same problem. But if I spent my entire talk bashing on backup solutions, we'd never get out of here. The server uses default ports of over a 2,000 port range in both UDP and TCP. The client uses over 20,000 ports over TCP and UDP. Boy, I feel sorry for that firewall administrator. Guess what? It runs its own port mapper. And I'm sure that's been heavily security audited, just like the Sun RPC port mapper has. You can restrict the ports that it runs on, but guess what? If you restrict it to one port, you can only run one backup at a time. If you restrict it to two, you can run two. So how lucky do you feel? You've got authentication between the client and the server unclear, as I brought about before. A Legato server, you can't just arbitrarily connect to a Legato server. You have to have a username and password and everything's cool. But the server connecting to the client actually goes through no authentication mechanism whatsoever. NAT is not supported at all in Legato, and it's unable to determine what interface it listens on. One of the problems that I often see, and you'll see this in other protocols, is that system management binds to everything. So if I got a dual-homed host, I've got my backup software binding to an untrusted segment. Well, my firewall rule set prevents me from outsiders connecting to it, but that's not secure, because if I'm able to compromise another host on that segment, well, then I've got a backup server that's listening on an untrusted interface that I can quickly connect to. So let's talk about monitoring solutions. So we got SNMP. Let me just say a few things about SNMP. Just assume that anything that's sent over SNMP is readable by all. That doesn't matter whether it's V1, V or V2. It doesn't matter. Community strength should obviously be changed from the traditional public and private. And if possible, you should limit the host that can query SNMP on the queried device itself. Cisco routers, you can actually say what machine should be sending SNMP queries. You should also examine the type of information that your device gives you via SNMP. You might think that it just sometimes just gives you, you know, whether I'm up or I'm down, whether I've got, what's my CPU utilization, what's my memory. And that's about it. But actually, for example, one of the things that have caused NT administrators to stay awake at nights is actually at the SNMP library for the Microsoft Windows NT. You can query it for shares, you can query it for usernames, groups, and all kinds of other things that you wouldn't normally expect to see over SNMP. Now, you can manually unregister parts of those in the system, but guess what? That configuration is not supported by Microsoft. You can determine the criticality of the information, whether or not to use SNMP. If you've got a device that has a relatively sane MIB base that isn't going to give away the farm with one rogue query, then maybe it's okay to run. You should never, however, allow reconfiguration of devices via SNMP. You should disable write privileges on any SNMP device. Traps should be used sparingly, and there should be a dedicated receiver on the DMZ. You shouldn't be broadcasting traps to an internal network, or you have to allow SNMP from the outside DMZ into your internal network where you have an OpenView receiver. Install the OpenView receiver in the DMZ. Unfortunately, oftentimes SNMP is the lesser of another evil. You know what that other evil is? Vendor proprietary management extensions, specialized daemons that run that give you status of the services. Those are oftentimes even worse. At least people have been looking at SNMP. The ICMP, that's a pretty common. Oh, sorry.
What about SNMP version 3?
Some of the authentication mechanisms are promising, but again, I would go to taking a look at what the devices are giving up over SNMP, and automatically just assume that anything that's going over SNMP is readable by all. I'm not bashing SNMP. It's a great monitoring tool and a good way for example, having network operation centers be able to give network administrators and system administrators useful information when troubleshooting at 3 a.m. in the morning. The CPU load has gone up to 100, or the disk, has failed. It's very useful. You just have to balance and perform proper risk mitigation. ICMP is another one where you have to do that. You have echo, reply, and request, which is usually fine on an internal interface, but you should be able to throttle your ICMP response queue. For example, you can do that in the BSDs and other types of Unixes. So now we've talked about monitoring, we've talked about backup. Now let's talk a little bit about remote administration. I'll start with console access because I find that this is a really interesting thing to start working on. So you've got console access, and you foresee console access ports on a lot of stuff these days. You see them on your traditional routers and switches, load balancers. And now you also see them on UPSs and other interesting devices. You should aggregate your console connections to a terminal server. You can use a hardware terminal server that with a serial or network interface to a PC that maintains access. Conserve is a great freeware product that allows you to manage console connections on a Linux host and using like Cyclades or Cisco's or Lightwaves or all kinds of cool terminal servers out there that give you access to those hosts. And some of those newer terminal servers actually support direct network connections via SSH using Radius support and IP filtering. Pretty darn cool. Often a lot of those use embedded Linux, which is a neat feature. You can also connect out of band via dial-up modem with a callback feature. So for example, if the network dies completely, well, guess what? You're not connecting via SSH to your console server anymore. So, I can actually, call into that modem and have it call me back so I can find out what's going on and initiate a console connection to my upstream router to find out why the network is down. It saves me a lot of time. So there's advantages. You can also log console messages to a terminal server. When I was administering a bunch of Solaris boxes, usually the most interesting messages were the ones that flew across the console after syslog had died. guess what? If I'm just using a traditional syslog server, I'm not going to catch that. So it's often great to have console messages being logged to a terminal server. You can also use it as a central point of authentication into the console management. And it provides the ability to turn off Telnet and other administrative clear text protocols on a network segment. There are still a lot of network devices out there that only allow Telnet. Well, guess what? You can turn off Telnet now and connect via the console server over an SSH connection to the console server instead. If SSH or administrative interfaces fail to respond, the administrator can connect directly to the console without physically going to the DMZ. One of my favorite war stories for that was people who follow FreeBSD and the current branch, there was a bug in one of the commits to SSHD. And so all these administrators blindly upgraded their systems, patched their SSHD, and the SSHD didn't restart, and most of these servers were in co-location facilities, you know, anywhere from 10 miles to 200 to 2,000 miles away. Oh crap! So what they had to do is they had to spend an entire weekend, you know, driving over to the co-location facility, restoring their SSH daemon and restarting it so they can administer the boxes again. Well, guess what? If you use a console server, you've got another ways of a means of access. There's some disadvantages. You got to deal with a break problem, in particular in Solaris host. If you disconnect a console, as I'm sure a lot of you have found, that goes into boot prom mode. Most modern day terminal servers will deal with this properly and can keep the proper connection even after you've changed focus from the console server from between one Sun host to another. You've got additional hardware and cabling that you have to do. I've seen really bad terminal server implementations where you've got all these cables just flying everywhere, and so you've got 7 cables coming out of every host. It's really ugly, so you have to make sure that you have proper cable management discipline before you go into that. You've got to have authentication and logging for console use once the user has accessed the terminal server, which is difficult to implement with a hardware device. A lot of these devices are great at maintaining authentication, but they're not very great at logging access. Another common form of implementation that I've seen is actually SSH bastion gateways. It's one hardened point of entry into via SSH to the other host. You see that, for example, in this network design. You can use an SSH agent to eliminate interactivity on the gateway when maintaining a single host that can SSH the endpoints. So you can really lock down the SSH daemon on the host without compromising your ability to maintain those boxes. You should always use RSA identity files, never use just plain old passwords. You should disable our host authentication and root login. Always have your users log in with a unique username and then su to root or sudo. You should bind SSH only to the admin LAN interfaces. Oftentimes when I do audits to networks, I see them do everything right except that they just bind SSHD to 0.0.0.0 so that they're listening on SSH on every interface that's installed on the box. They should only bind it to the admin LAN. Watch your patch levels. SSH, of course, is a very popular target. Well, also, not to think that I'm Unix-centric, there's also the Windows problem. So you've got two popular options with Windows GUI, PC Anywhere and Windows Terminal Servers. You see PC Anywhere often running with Windows NT 4 and Windows Terminal Services running with 2000. So there's a lot of risks presented with PC Anywhere. It runs on a well-known port. You got previous versions that have been vulnerable to denial of service attacks and weak password encryption. And the typical configuration, and you can't change this in the GUI, binds to all interfaces, so that anyone who can bypass your router and firewall and initiate a PC Anywhere connection will be able to do so on the untrusted interface. And you should avoid exposing it on the untrusted network segment. And of course, the typical configuration out of the box, PC Anywhere actually bypasses the Windows login mechanism. So what do I mean by that? So administrator A logs in to PC Anywhere. He hits his Control-Alt-Delete, logs into the box, and then does his work, and then disconnects. leaving himself logged in. Administrator B comes in, doesn't like Administrator A too much, dissed his coding skills, logs in to PC Anywhere and says, oh, guess what? Administrator A is still logged in. What kinds of things can I screw up for him today? So you don't have any way of actually controlling the login mechanism. You can configure PC Anywhere to automatically log out a user when they disconnect via PC Anywhere, and that should be the way that it's configured. You should also make use of the allowed IP addresses feature so that you can limit admin host. You should also enable TCP/IP host bind mode to only listen on administrative interface. So this is the way to do it. And I have a link here that you guys can copy down. I'm sorry this wasn't in your slides. I forgot to add that. This is a link to the Semantic Knowledge Base article. You actually have to change the registry in order to only have it bind to certain interfaces. If you're paranoid, you should change the default port of PC Anywhere. You should always make sure that the user's logged off after session disconnect. You should enable event logging and session recording if disk space permits. One of the cool things that PC Anywhere does provide you is the ability to record the GUI session. So sometimes I've had to allow less than trustworthy vendors to connect to my host via PC Anywhere, and I don't trust what they do. And so if I'm not around to watch them, I can record the host what they have done from every mouse click and review those later on. So if you can, if you have the disk space, go ahead and record that. You can utilize symmetric encryption and deny lower level. You can actually use X509 for host authentication if you want to. You should be able to disable the response to PC Anywhere query broadcast so that it, for example, I don't know if any of you have been on a cable modem or something like that, or a DSL line, and all of a sudden you see a PC, and you're running an IDS, and all of a sudden you see all these PC Anywhere probes. That's the default behavior. When you bring up a PC Anywhere client, it actually does a UDP port probe of every host on its segment in order to determine which PC Anywhere hosts are out there. Well, you can actually disable your servers if you are actually running PC Anywhere to not respond to those probes. You can configure your clients to only use TCP to connect rather than a UDP query to initiate the connection, which reduces your firewall rule set. The more UDP I can eliminate out of my firewall rule set, the happier I am. Separate user account for each admin with strong passwords, so you shouldn't have a shared administrator a PC Anywhere account, for example. And you should limit your login attempts. Don't allow someone to try and brute force it. And you should only use PC Anywhere user with PC Anywhere privilege. So, for example, you can actually integrate Windows authentication into PC Anywhere. I wouldn't recommend it. So then you've got the Windows GUI. Yeah, with terminal services. It utilizes the Windows authentication mechanism. It runs on a well-known port, and again, you should avoid exposing it on an untrusted network segment. I'm going to talk just briefly about how to secure Windows terminal service for administrative use. You can also, of course, use Windows terminal service that is for application deployment. I'm not going to talk about that here. You should only bind it to the administrative segment interface, and that's actually doable within the Microsoft Management Control Console, so that's a lot easier to do. You should also force all configuration parameters at the server level. For some reason, Windows Terminal Server will allow the client to override certain security parameters when it connects, unless you actually set that checkbox. You should use a separate Windows Terminal Server login from your Windows login and give each administrator a unique login with a strong password. That way, of course, your users should not be using their administrator passwords to do their day-to-day work, and you also need to be able to audit the work that they do. You should take the administrator's group out of the connection permissions. By default, anyone in the administrator group can connect to the Windows Terminal Server, so you need to take that group out, create your own group, and add individual users that you want to connect in. Enable auditing. Remove the TS Internet user account, which is actually installed by default for no good reason. utilize high encryption for RDP. RDP is a protocol that runs on Windows Terminal Services, and disconnect idle and broken connections aggressively. There have been some known exploits of actually hijacking Windows Terminal sessions that were not that were broken abnormally. And if you're paranoid, you can change the Windows Terminal Services port. So finally, I want to talk about log solutions. All kinds of logs out there. There's your traditional syslog, where you have Unix and network devices that either write to the local file system or send information over the network over UDP port 514. You've got your Windows NT 2000 event logs that write to the local file system. However, there is network support for syslog available for third parties. And then there's application and service log files that you can use a variety of different forms: syslog, Windows NT event log, flat files, binary files, or database entries. So you got all these disparate types of logs. What's the management need? Well, the management need is to centralize those logs for analysis. So let's first focus on network syslog. So if possible, you should limit which hosts can send log entries to a host. Heartbeat creation and detection is absolutely imperative for centralization. I get a lot of people who tell me, so what's the point? You know, if I centralize the log, the first thing the attacker is going to do when he gets on the host, he's going to kill the syslog D process, and then I'm not going to get any more information. Well, guess what? Someone killing syslog D is an event that you should know about. And so you need to set up heartbeat monitoring. So the syslog just goes every minute, every 30 seconds to the syslog server, a log event. I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. And then when it stops saying I'm here, you've got a problem. Flood detection is also imperative. So if you've got a situation where another common criticism I see of log centralization over network syslog is, well, they'll just flood my logs, you know, they'll send a bunch of crap to my port. Well, guess what? That's a security incident as well. If you're not logging for if you're not watching your logs for a certain number of log entries per second, then you're not really watching your logs. You've got to make sure that you contend for those possibilities. Syslog server should sit on administrative lands whenever possible. Make sure that clients are sending messages over the administrative LAN interface, not over the untrusted interface. And there are initiatives out there for secure syslog, but they're not even close to implementation yet, going through the traditional IETF shuffle. You've got log signing, you've got encrypted transfer, and prevention of insertion deletion attacks. You should take a look at the working group for syslog and see what's out there and see what people are thinking. Believe it or not, there's still not a standard RFC for syslog implementation, even though it was one of the first protocols and services running on Unix. They're finally trying to rectify that now. Take a look at syslog NG. There's actually a bunch of other new next generation syslog programs that have been popping up lately. I haven't had a chance to take a look at some of the newer ones, but syslog NG is the one that I always use. It gives you the ability to sort by host, to use regular expressions to actually define log files. So you can say, I want to put all log files from X host of IIS server logs of type 505 in this file. It gives you that level of granularity, which is pretty darn cool. So then you've got your NT and 2000 event logs. You need to get those logs off the server as quickly as possible. There's two major options for this. You can use agent-based forwarding, such as there are syslog daemons out there for Windows NT and Windows 2000. Sabernet .net has a free implementation of syslog daemon for Windows NT. There's also a very nice shareware version of Event Reporter at www.eventreporter.com that has a really good daemon that works well that I often use in NT deployments. There's also commercial solutions, you know, such as the OpenView agents and other compact insight agent, all those types of things. You got batch retrieval, where you can use common resource kit utilities to pull logs out of there either by binary format or by text format, such as dump EL and the resource kit utility. You got to ask yourself the question, are you going to be pushing or pulling those logs? And if the log is cleared by the intruder, again, you better know about it. You might want to use a Perl script on the local on your local NT boxes just to check every once in a while for event ID 517, which is event log cleared. You can use the active state event Perl with the event log module that's available. There's a lot more information about Windows NT event logging and integration with syslog. You can take a look at my SANS NetSec 2000 presentation for many more details. If you go to www.securify/labs, you can download that presentation. Then you've got your flat file logs. Well, you could always syslog them, I guess. You could tail F and pipe them to logger if you want. Probably not the best solution. You need to get them off the originator as soon as possible. If they're too big or cumbersome, like for example web access files, things like that, go ahead and cull them during the push or pull process on the host themselves rather than waiting until they get to the centralization host. So if you got a bunch of crap in the log that you don't care about, get rid of it at the agent. Don't wait until it gets to the centralization point. How often to push or pull? You got to kind of play a little war game with yourself. It's like, examine the criticality of the logs, and then analyze the worst case scenario. Someone blows away your log file, and you've got to recreate what happened. How far back do you want to have your log files? Is it a minute that you get a new log file every minute? Is it every hour? Is it a day? Is it a week? What is it? And if the log disappears, you better know about it. There was a neat presentation yesterday by the authors of Fenord, which I guess isn't available yet, but they talked about running processes in the background that were completely hidden, and you could have something that checks to make sure the log file doesn't get blown away, or that an intruder isn't able to change the log file at all, or even though it looks like they are, by using a kernel module. So overall, you want to look out for administrative interfaces, such as the Cold Fusion administrator login, which I see. Another one that I've seen a lot lately, actually, when doing pen tests, is Tomcat. Tomcat has an admin servlet that's installed by default. And if you install Tomcat and don't disable the context of that admin servlet, attackers can go there and deregister the context of your entire server or remap the contents to the root file system and then browse the root file system from there. You need to follow best practices, in particular in regards to resource utilization, making sure that you're not throwing too much on the pipe, segmenting your pipes so that you can easily look at what's going on your network and actually be able to use your snort, use your Argus, use your TCP dump in a strong way. Make sure that your system management protocols use authentication and question the integrity of the data that those systems are providing for you. So with that, that's my presentation. And if you've got questions, go ahead. Yes, actually, I recently performed a penetration test breaking into a Citrix ICA host from the remote. The encryption has been improved dramatically. Unfortunately, being able to lock down Citrix hosts to not allow access to the command prompt is actually quite difficult. So that's my concern on there. It's not so much the encryption protocol, but actually control the OS once Citrix is installed. Go ahead.
What's your opinion on using VLAN to separate front end from the back end?
So this is one of the greatest debates of all time between network engineers and security engineers. Network engineers think VLANs are the future of the world, and you're seeing like these big Cat 6000 switches with actual using complete VLANs with route switch modules built into the switch, using VLANs to do all the segmentation. There have been known exploits of jumping VLANs, particularly at broadcast addresses. VLANs are not by their fault designed for security. They're designed for aggregation. They're designed for convenience. When you use a switch or you use a hub, you're trying to create points of aggregation into the network. It is not a device that is used for segmentation of the network, as routers, firewalls, those types of devices are used for segmentation. So you use the intended tools the way that they're intended to use. I guess I probably put myself on one side of the debate there. Go ahead. I haven't really looked into those solutions very well, and I haven't really seen a solution that I've liked. As far as console access, there are ways. I've seen some interesting hacks where people have bound command shells to serial ports on Windows NT in 2000 and hooked them up actually to modems to have kind of the last resort connection, which is similar to the lights out type of connection. I haven't really taken a look at how the security implications of that are. Other questions? Yeah. www.securify.com/labs. I've seen that, actually. I've seen people run SNMP and maybe one other thing, like maybe backup on that. You got to ask yourself, why are you doing it? If you're doing it for security, more power to you, although it is oftentimes an additional deployment. But if you're doing it because there's so much SNMP traffic that it needs its own dedicated segment, then you oftentimes have other network engineering problems. So it just depends. Other questions? Well, thank you very much.
I'm trying to convince our network admins that VLANs are not the way